This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel, along with Robert Talese, Sarah Tyson, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with John Robson, assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Nottingham. His new book, Aesthetic Testimony, An Optimistic Approach, is just out from Oxford University Press. A lot of what we claim to know, we learn from other people's testimony. They tell us, and in many ordinary contexts, that is enough to gain knowledge. But for many philosophers, aesthetics is different. Facts about aesthetic properties, such as Shakespeare's Hamlet being a tragedy, or Picasso's Guernica being anti-war, can't be transmitted by testimony and can only be learned through first-person experience. In his new book, Robson argues that aesthetic testimony should be treated on a par with testimony in other domains. Our deference to others in aesthetic matters is about the same as it is in other areas of knowledge. He also defends a view called contextualist optimism, in which we can gain aesthetic knowledge through testimony, and that just as with testimony in other domains, whether we do depends on the context in which the aesthetic judgments are transmitted. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, John Robson. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Oh, hi, Carrie. Great to be here.
I'm really excited to be talking about your book, Aesthetic Testimony, An Optimistic Approach. And it's true. The book is full of optimism about something that people have had a lot of pessimism about. Before we get to the contents of the book, tell us a bit about yourself and, you know, how you became a philosopher and how you came to write this book.
Great. Yeah. So I think, weirdly, I got into philosophy because I went to an open day at the University of Leeds where I studied, and a friend of mine was interested in philosophy and dragged me along to their little sort of talk on that. And I got really into what was being said and started reading philosophy and stuff. So, yeah, it was quite an odd introduction. And then a lot of my early philosophy career, and my PhD, for example, focused a lot on metaphysics. But after that, I moved into issues in philosophy of art via some work I did on philosophy of video games with Aaron Meskin. And then, yeah, got interested in the topic of aesthetic testimony. I think particularly because it's one of those things that what happens to a lot of philosophers where you read a lot of things where people are saying something that doesn't kind of quite sit right with you. That happened very much in the aesthetic testimony debate that I think certainly at the time, perhaps less so now, a lot of people took it for granted that something like the view I call pessimism was true, that there's something wrong or problematic about forming aesthetic judgments on the basis of testimony. And again, that's something that seemed very strange to me, still does, so kind of all that kind of view. So I think that's kind of why I'm mainly going to this particular topic.
Okay, good. And it is interesting because the initial or intuitive response that one might get is precisely the one of the pessimistic view of aesthetic testimony is, you know, how can I learn about the aesthetic properties of an artwork without actually experiencing it myself? How can I do it secondhand, so to speak, from testimony? So to get us started, maybe you could say just very generally again, you know, to orient everybody, you know, what is aesthetic testimony? Why is everybody so pessimistic about it? Basically those two questions.
Great. So I think, first of all, it might be worth saying a bit about just testimony in general, because I think testimony can sound like very official, very like something that happens in a trial or an inquest or something. But typically when philosophers talk about testimony, they mean something very broad. We talk about just things like tellings generally, that kind of thing. So, you know, testimony is just any case where you tell someone else or something else assumes the case. You tell people where you live, you tell people how to bake a particular kind of cake, you tell people, you know, when you were born, you tell people what the weather's like outside.
Mm-hmm.
So testimony is a very broad range of things. And historically, that's tended to be neglected quite a lot by philosophers as a source of knowledge. So lots of focus on things like perception, things like argumentation, of course, but not much focus on testimony. That's changed quite a lot recently. So lots of people in sort of last sort of 50 years ago, starting people like Cody, and then a lot of very other prominent people, Fricker, Lackey, etc., started to write a lot on testimony in general, and argued that, well, testimony really is kind of an important, indispensable source of knowledge in our everyday life. And a lot of people have gone along with that thought, think either that's true, there are some areas where there are exceptions. So moral philosophy, for example, a lot of people think that ethics is an exception, and aesthetics is another area. So what exactly we mean by aesthetics is a whole big debate, but roughly the thought is, well, properties like being beautiful or being ugly or being graceful or elegant, things like this would be what people mean when they talk about aesthetic properties. So roughly the kind of properties used when talking about and evaluating artworks. So kind of a lot of people think, well, if I tell you an artwork was produced by a certain artist in a certain year, in a certain style, it's a certain size, a certain color, if it's a painting, for example, those facts seem like ones that most philosophers would allow that I could come to know very easily on the basis of testimony. By contrast, when I say this piece of music is hauntingly beautiful, or if someone says this film is elegant in its exhibition of a particular story or something, a lot of people, even those who are quite happy with testimony in general as a source of knowledge, would think there's some kind of exception here, some reason why we can't come to know or can't come to what to believe these things on the basis of testimony. So the question about why is a lot of people are what the book calls pessimists. So this terminology that comes from Rob Hopkins. So Rob Hopkins is himself a pessimist.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I made a mistake in naming the positions, I think, because, well, you know, optimism sounds nicer, optimism sounds more fun, but you named his own position. And yeah, the pessimist, I think, yeah, what this pessimism can vary an awful lot. I think typically the pessimist will, as you say, I think their position is a common sense one, but it's often hard to know what exactly motivates that view. So I think certainly a lot of people might endorse pessimism just because they endorse a more general skepticism about testimony in other areas, but that's typically not the kind of motivation I think most philosophical pessimists would take. Similarly, a lot of people in your folk discussion might just say, well, when it comes to what's beautiful, ugly, etc., that's just all like a matter of opinion, there's no right and wrong,
right,
etc. And again, it held that kind of view. You might think, well, if that's right, you can't learn things on the basis of testimony because, well, there's not really any fact to be learned. But again, that's not the kind of thing a lot of philosophical defenders of pessimism endorse. So yeah, given that, I think that often pessimists find themselves in quite a strange position, thinking, well, what is it that explains or justifies pessimism? So I think that's kind of how a lot of the literature has been framed, thinking, well, pessimism is kind of really intuitively correct, but how do we explain or justify that? How do we explain or justify the contrast with testimony about shapes and sizes and colours and whatever else seems to be fine? Why is the aesthetic case problematic?
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that different pessimists will disagree about. Some people will focus on, for example, the role of understanding. That's something that Arsene Hills talks about a lot in the aesthetic case and the ethical case, that thinks, well, in kind of most cases, the norm for proper belief is something like knowledge, whereas perhaps when it comes to things like aesthetics or ethics, the norm for proper judgment is something more like understanding. But again, very different pessimists give very different explanations. Again, people like Bob Hopkins, T. Wen, others give very different explanations for what's going on here. But I think, again, less so now, thankfully, but particularly in the early years of debate, a lot of focus seemed to be, well, here's like sort of a fact, how do we explain it? So the kind of pessimism, when people like Walheim or the debate talk about pessimism, don't use that phrase, but what I'm talking about, the Aquinas principle, says that, well, a third judgment requires first-hand experience of the object, can't be transmitted from one person to the other. I mean, he talks about accepting very narrow limits, never explains what those limits are, but at least in general seems to rule out testimony along with other things as part of the Aquinas principle.
Right.
But again, Stoker is talking about, well, here's kind of you know, common sense sort of fact of the matter, that this kind of Aquinas principle is true, that we need to experience paintings, music, whatever else, for ourselves to make a set of judgments about that. That's what I take it as, I think, that any kind of proper, plausible view of the aesthetic needs to accommodate, rather than like a beautiful.
Right. So let's just get a, you know, so for example, I mean, contemporary example, the movie Barbie. You know, I much enjoyed it, and so I would give it a, you know, a couple thumbs up or something like that. So I would say, you know, just to be evaluative aesthetically, it was you know, good, it was powerful, or whatever, right? Some sort of adjective of approval. Whereas, you know, and somebody listening to me would not therefore be justified in thinking that the movie is in fact, you know, good or powerful or something like that. So, and somebody would naturally say, well, you know, maybe I should see it myself, and maybe you are persuasive enough to me that I should actually go do it, see it. And they go see it, and then they have their own opinion, and that's how they come to know whatever it is they know about it. That's sort of the, you know, the kind of the intuitive folk way of thinking about, you know, why there's a problem with taking somebody else's word for it when it comes to an aesthetic judgment. So what is your, you know, what is your essential, you know, response to that, that very powerful, I would say, intuition that you can tell me what you want about your opinion about that, and I might accept your opinion, but I certainly can't come to know that, you know, the movie is in fact good, or the, you know, painting is in fact, you know, beautiful, or something like that. I have to actually, I can't take your testimony at face value. That's the intuition. And you talk about this, you know, the sort of the folk intuitions, and you want to accommodate them, as you said. So how do you counter that?
Yeah, so I think that there's, I mean, quite a lot of parts to the response. I'll just kind of mention three things for now. I'm sure we'll get into other parts of it later on. I think the first thing to mention, I think a lot of the intuitions there are kind of motivated by a more general skepticism about testimony. So again, when they've done experimental philosophy work on this, it looks like a lot of people are very skeptical about aesthetic testimony, but are also much more skeptical about testimony in general than many philosophers would be. So this kind of, I mean, thinking about like the line from the song about believe half of what you see and none of what you hear. I mean, that sounds kind of quite plausible for people. You shouldn't just believe people. You shouldn't just take people's words for all sorts of things. But of course, if you think about it, people, I think, wouldn't really function at all if they didn't trust other people, take other people's word on all sorts of things. That, yeah, again, kind of lots of things happen in the world before I was born. Lots of things happen in the world I'm not directly perceiving myself, or not able to kind of demonstrate or prove myself. So I think, first of all, that a lot of the kind of folk resistance, I think, is motivated by an implausible kind of concern about testimony in general. I think, second, that a lot of the kind of resistance here among philosophers might come into certain worries you have about aesthetic testimony concerning, for example, disagreement. You might think, well, a lot of people think the Barbie movie wasn't great, for example. I've heard various criticisms of it. Again, it's a very popular movie, I think, generally well received, but certainly even in that case, there's, you know, it's criticism. Other cases, there's you know, a lot more debate, opinions a lot more divided, perhaps, than in that case. And again, a lot of people think, well, that kind of undermines one trust in my testimony. But I think that to the extent that you might think, well, the kind of presence of disagreement, so perhaps kind of people who know more about film than you, or kind of thought more about the kind of particular film than you, look more into whatever else might think relevant, disagree. A lot of people might think that would be a reason to doubt your testimony. But at the same time, I think if it is, it's also a reason to doubt your kind of first-hand judgment as well. So again, if there's reason for me to doubt your testimony because of disagreement or because of factors like that. That also seems like a reason to for you to doubt your own first-hand judgment. So again, I think that that's something that a lot of kind of pessimists want to draw a contrast and say, well, first-hand judgment is kind of good and somewhere better than relying on testimony. But I think a lot of things that might serve to undermine or serve to defeat us for judgments falling on the basis of testimony also seem to fall be some undermining of first-hand judgment. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I mean, I talk a bit in the book about things like snobbery. Again, I'm sure not you, but I think a lot of other people might think, well, their judgments are kind of snobbish or kind of influenced by irrelevant factors. Again, it's easy to make that kind of accusation against other people. But of course, people who are influenced by kind of snobbery or sort of other kind of relevant factors don't normally realize that about themselves. So that, again, I think just to the extent it's a reason to doubt other people's testimony, it all seems like a reason to doubt your own judgment.
Well, let me push back on that.
Great.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the essential, you know, the crux of the matter is that if you're expressing an opinion, then you're not going to get knowledge from that opinion, knowledge about whatever it is that the opinion is about. You'll gain knowledge what somebody's opinion is, but not what the opinion is about. And I think the fundamental problem with art or with aesthetic testimony is that we recognize immediately that these judgments are opinions. And sometimes I will, you know, I will not read critics because I don't agree with their opinion generally or whatever. But I can recognize that, you know, it's my opinion that, you know, let's say I thought, you know, Barbie was a great deal of fun. That's my opinion. And somebody can learn that I thought it was a great deal of fun, but they're not going to learn whether the movie itself is fun. And they can't, because it's just a matter of opinion what aesthetic properties a particular work has. So I think that seems to be the fundamental problem. I was just wondering, you know, how do you address that?
Yeah, so I think that was kind of actually going to be the thing I was about to move on to.
Okay, yeah, good.
About, well, kind of what we mean when we talk about opinion here. So I think the example is of fun. I think a lot of people wouldn't want to necessarily count that as itself being an aesthetic property. So going back to talk about judgments of personal taste and this idea that, well, judgments of personal taste differ from aesthetic judgments because in some sense they don't demand agreement. We don't expect agreement. We don't expect other people to kind of share them. So the thought is like this: well, if you tell me you find, you know, strawberries delicious, then you know, if I was kind of really strange about trying to convince you otherwise, that does seem a bit weird. If I'm trying to argue that strawberries aren't as delicious as you think, or argue that you're wrong about how strawberries taste, or how they taste to you at least. By contrast, it looks like when it comes to aesthetics, I mean, people do argue a lot about aesthetic matters. So if I start to tell you that your favorite band is rubbish, you're not going to go, well, that's cool, John, whatever, man, your opinion. Mm-hmm. I think that, yeah, people, I mean, what, I think one of the most common things people do debate is aesthetic matters. People debate films, they debate music, they debate many areas like this. And a lot of these debates do focus on aesthetic issues. And again, I think unlike the sort of strawberry case, people seem to give arguments. So it feels like, well, trying to argue out of thinking strawberries are delicious seems like a strange, kind of bizarre move to take. Whereas again, trying to argue against a specific view about a film, certainly kind of, I wouldn't want to try to argue against your having enjoyed it. That would be a strange thing to argue. But arguing against sort of being kind of good or insightful or original in certain ways, that's the kind of thing I think does seem very kind of commonplace, where it looks like, again, people often are persuaded by reasons, I think. Again, I think people's views are typically, on certain matters, a lot less kind of independent, a lot less it's kind of people that experience things themselves and kind of form their judgments and their things. So I think kind of two aspects there. I think one that, again, I think what we meant by opinion can be a bit tricky, but I think certainly there seems to be a sense, a lot of people think, including, I think, most pessimists, that we talk about opinion, if we do talk about that in aesthetic matters, that's quite a different thing from just an opinion about what's kind of fun or what I enjoy or something. And again, it seems more like kind of case where we can give reasons. I think that, again, some recent work I've done with Becky Wallbank talks about this idea that a lot of aesthetic practice, I think, is communal, is like a social thing in a way that, again, I think often gets downplayed. We think about people just looking at a painting in a gallery or listening to some music or watching a film. But of course, these are often things we do with other people. We kind of, you know, we engage it with art itself with other people. We talk about art with other people a lot of the time. So I think one big thing I talk about in the book is a lot of kind of pessimism is motivated by the idea that, well, look, you know, we can defer to other people about what planets there are, what happened in the past, and what shapes and colors various things are. But we don't defer to people about aesthetic matters. And I think that's mistaken. I think that, as a matter of fact, we defer a lot more than we think about aesthetic matters. A lot more of our aesthetic judgments, our aesthetic beliefs are influenced by what the people say and what people's views are.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Okay, fair enough. So that's an important distinction, you know, between, you know, I mean, so yeah, you can say that, you know, some play by Shakespeare is, you know, is a great play, whatever. And you can still not like it, right? You know, so those are two different, you know, sorts of judgments, and that's perfectly fine. But let's just focus on the judgments of, you know, Hamlet is a great play, or A Sense and Sensibility is a, you know, a fantastic novel, you know, whatever your aesthetic, you know, your aesthetic predicates might be. So let's just focus on those. And we do differ in a lot of those. Hmm. But how does that show that, how do I put it? How does it show that there's a fact of the matter that I can learn by somebody telling me that Shakespeare, you know, that Hamlet is a great play?
Yeah, good. So I think that, in a sense, the kind of fact of the matter claim is something that I think is largely held in common between most sides of debate here. So I think that certainly if kind of mean fact, at least quite generally, I think even expressivist views of aesthetics would allow there are facts, and these facts are, you know, open grabs in some sense. Similarly, kind of relativists, they might think the facts are, like, aren't like straightforward. X is beautiful, or something like X is beautiful relative to a particular group, a particular standard, a particular whatever. But I think typically the idea there is some fact of the matter tends to be held pretty much in common between both optimists and pessimists in the debate. So certainly I think kind of that denying there's any fact of the matter would be in a sense one way to endorse pessimism. But then I talk about in the book the kind of pessimism isn't just meant to be the kind of the view that there's something problematic about aesthetic testimony. It's particularly thinking there's something problematic in comparison both to testimony about other matters and to first-hand aesthetic judgment. And of course, if there is no fact of the matter here at all, then I can't get access to fact of the matter via looking at a painting or listening to some music either. So I guess the thought is just, well, I can't know that what the aesthetic claim is because there's no fact of the matter. That would mean I can't know it on the basis of testimony, but also I can't know it on the basis of first-hand experience, etc. So yeah, I can know perhaps I find it fun, but again, I find it beautiful, or I find it whatever else. But of course, I think it's very controversial. You can learn that on the basis of my testimony. That no one thinks, well, if I tell you I find this painting beautiful, I don't think you can't learn that on the basis of testimony. So yeah.
So let me just, you know, just to clarify, you're saying, okay, one way to be a pessimist, obviously, is to deny that there are facts of the matter about aesthetic judgments, about these aesthetic properties. Okay. But, you're saying, but many people on both sides of the debate, either pessimists or optimists, agree that there are aesthetic facts of the matter.
Yes. And I think
particularly... okay, so they're not denying, you know, aesthetic testimony you know, just sort of, you know, off the bat, so to speak. But so within the group, within the among the pessimists who think, yeah, there are facts of the matter, which potentially, I mean, if there is a fact of the matter, then potentially it could be known. And that there's nothing, you know, nothing different about, presumably, well, this is where they differ. Somehow aesthetic facts of the matter are, you know, inferior or flawed, or their transmission is flawed or damaged in testimonial exchanges. So there's something about the facts, either there's something about the facts, the aesthetic facts that people agree on, that makes them not transmissible by testimony, or there's something about the testimonial, you know, transmission, you might say, that messes them up or something. So so how do you know, what do these pessimists who do agree that there are facts of the matter, aesthetic facts of the matter, Hamlet is a great play, you know, what exactly do they find wrong, right? You talk about the, you know, first and second, you know, there's an asymmetry here between facts of the matter in other domains and these facts of the matter.
Yeah, good. So I think that there's various different things that might say there. So I think, as you say, the idea is something like this. Well, like, typically pessimists won't deny the fact of the matter because they'll think, well, at least kind of broadly speaking, there's some fact of the matter I can know via probably judged by a first-hand experience of a work. The problem comes in, as I say, with the testimony bit in their view. Mm-hmm. So again, yeah, so I think someone who thought that there was no fact of the matter at all, or someone who kind of like a general skeptic about testimony or general skeptic about the aesthetic, I think that kind of wouldn't be typically the idea a pessimist would want to defend. They want to say, well, look, when it comes to first-hand judgment, That's the good stuff that gets us something like a fact of the matter, at least kind of broadly speaking. Again, some will say like much more committal than that. Some will be perhaps a bit more hedging. Well, something at least kind of like a fact of the matter, broadly speaking, is kind of gettable. We get that by experience ourselves if we're kind of properly situated, properly qualified, etc. But as you say, something goes wrong in the testimonial case, and what that is that kind of goes wrong. That's a big area debate between pessimists. So in the book, I roughly divide pessimists into three camps. So the first camp is what I call constitutive pessimists. And their thought is, well, something about what aesthetic judgment is that it just kind of can't be transmitted. So something like aesthetic judgment isn't just a straightforward belief. It's kind of, you know, something like an experience or something experience-like that's kind of tied to the judgment as well. So that in order to kind of properly judge that this work is beautiful, I have not just kind of have the right kind of evidence, I have to experience the beauty in some way. And that would mean that, well, I just literally can't like transmit that judgment by testimony. Another view would say, this is the unavailability pessimist, that, well, that judgment at least typically can't be transmitted because there'd be some failure of knowledge in an attempt to transmit it. There's some kind of reason why you as a testifier would know that Barbie is an excellent film, but I can't learn that on the basis of your testimony because there's some kind of epistemic deficiency. There's some lack of knowledge here. But again, explaining why that is going to be the challenge. Mm-hmm. And that view is sometimes called unusability pessimism. And that in a way thinks, well, there's nothing actually wrong with the judgment itself. The judgment itself can be kind of great, can be very nice and upstanding, but there's something wrong with me accepting that judgment. So what Hopkins says in his kind of discussion, well, if I accept the belief, it would count as knowledge, but there's some non-epistemic norm against my doing that. So like T. Wren, for example, looks at things about the function of aesthetic judgment, thinks that given the kind of what we kind of want from aesthetic judgment, we want from aesthetic practice, there's something kind of problematic about, well, at least in certain cases, how we're doing that. So again, I think T's not kind of a straightforward pessimist, but I think that at least in some cases, I think given the aims we have in aesthetic practice, there's kind of problems with acting in these non-autonomous ways, the falling judgments by testimony that it's not really a problem with the judgment itself. It's more a problem, again, with what we want out of the aesthetic practice.
Okay, good, good. That was helpful. So so you call your view contextualist optimism. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, great. So the thought here is that it's been modeled on kind of a contextualist view in epistemology more generally. Mm-hmm. And again, I think we could use this kind of quite broadly. So it doesn't necessarily have to be contextualism properly so-called. I think a lot of similar views can be used as well. But the rough thought is that famous kind of contextualist cases, say someone sort of says to you, hey, do you know what time the train is? And you say, yeah, it's kind of 5 p.m. And I sort of say like, well, are you sure? I'm meeting a friend, I don't want to be late. And you sort of say, oh yes, definitely. I read the train timetable an hour ago. That sort of seems like, well, I think they know the train is at 5 p.m. I'm talking to you. But now, like, imagine you say the train's at 5 p.m. and they say, well, are you sure? Because I've got to make it to a job interview, that like my dream job. And if I'm late, I won't get the job. And the trains do change their timetables, remember? So that could have happened since the one you kind of read was printed or something. I mean, again, it might be still printed timetables. That's very old school, but they might think that. Mm-hmm. But there are certain factors like the importance of the issue under discussion, factors like raising what's called relevant alternatives, cases where your view might turn out to be mistaken. Those can sort of take you from a position where you'll say, truly, I do know the train's at 5 p.m., to a position where you say, well, actually, I don't know the train's at 5 p.m. And at least the rough thought there is, well, your knowledge hasn't really changed, your position hasn't changed, but the kind of like linguistic context has changed in a way, so it's like the standards of saying, I know the train's at 5 p.m. have shifted. Mm-hmm. And I think things can happen like this when it comes to aesthetic testimony. So lots of these discussions, people, for example, will raise various skeptical kind of worries and say, well, your friend says this film's great, but what if you watched it yourself and found out it was terrible? So lots of examples people raise these kind of skeptical scenarios. Similarly, kind of, I think often these debates happen when people are really, really into aesthetics, talking about aesthetic matters they really care about. I think there's some focus there on aesthetics. So I think that the contextualist view, I think, is trying to kind of, in a way, allow that at least some of the pessimistic intuitions will be accurate. So in particular cases where pessimist says, well, hey, you don't actually know that P, you don't know this is beautiful by testimony in that case, I think the contextualist optimist can say, well, yes, that's right, because of certain contextual factors, standards for being able to say truly, I know that it's beautiful, are shifted, so I can't say that. But again, it's not because of any deficiency in aesthetic testimony, that's just because of some deficiency, some factor of the political context that people are in. And again, similar contextual moves could be used to create problems for kind of first-hand aesthetic judgment testing about other matters as well. So the idea is that it allows for that, while also allowing for a lot of optimistic intuition. So that typically, I think, a lot of kind of pessimism is motivated by quite narrow range of aesthetic cases. So talking about, as we did at the start, the kind of Barbie movie, kind of contemporary film that's kind of quite recent, that is kind of quite debated. Whereas other cases, for example, we talked a bit earlier about Shakespeare's plays, cases like that kind of passed what's called the test of time. A lot of people, I think, seem a lot happier to take testimony about those from like generations of critics, rather than just like taking testimony from one person about a film. Similarly, to testimony about the beauty of nature. So if like people telling you the Northern Lights are beautiful, I think a lot of people are happy to take that on the basis of testimony. Other cases, perhaps like testimony about scientific theories being beautiful or mathematical theories being beautiful. So I think that there's lots of interest that they actually do favour optimism. And thinking about pessimism as being the intuitive view, I think it has tended to be because of a focus on a certain range of cases. So we might think there's like a standoff that says, well, look, there's some nice pessimistic intuitions that the pessimist can accommodate, some optimistic intuitions that the optimist can accommodate, and that's about all it is. But I think that the optimist, in particular the contextualist optimist, mm-hmm. can do a lot more to capture pessimistic intuitions than the pessimist can do to capture optimistic ones.
Could you explain that a bit?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, so thinking about certain exceptions or certain examples, we might think, well, it looks like there are optimistic intuitions here. So think about judgments of canonical works like Shakespeare's plays, for example. Yeah.
So let me give it a. So I was just thinking, I was trying to think of an example of different contexts or different, changing standards of accepting that, perfectly fine testimonial transfer versus not. So if somebody were to tell a, student or whatever that, I don't know, Mansfield Park is a, is a great novel, maybe Austen's greatest novel, or something, I don't know. Then that might be a perfectly fine way to transmit the knowledge, the judgment, and then the hearer would know that Mansfield Park is a great novel. Whereas if somebody were to say this about some more obscure writer, that would be a case where there isn't testimonial knowledge. The hearer does not hear, it does not obtain testimonial knowledge or knowledge of the facts of the matter in that particular case because the writer is more obscure. Would that be a correct way to kind of interpret the contextualist move?
So I think it's something close to that, yeah. So I think that I think a lot of contextualist kind of moves involve things like raising relevant alternatives, saying, well, maybe you don't know because of ... And that kind of shifts the standard for knowledge in a way that you might have to kind of rule out that alternative in order to know the initial claim. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if I say kind of Mansfield Park is a great book, then you might think, well, what alternative is that kind of, if I read the book myself, I find out actually like all these critics for like generations have been wrong. It's just terrible. but that seems like, well, that's something I can rule out. That's pretty easy. That just seems kind of implausible. That doesn't seem like the kind of thing that I have to rule out kind of, either I would have to rule out very easily. Mm-hmm. Whereas, yeah, you sort of say, look, here's some obscure book that you really liked and think it's amazing. And someone says, well, what if you read the book for yourself and find out Perry's just wrong about this? And that seems perhaps a lot harder to rule out because, well, I don't really know you or your taste in books. I don't know how well informed you are about literature. So in that kind of case, once that kind of possibility is raised, that skeptical scenario, it seems a lot hard to kind of dismiss that or rule it out. Either by saying, look, that's just kind of fanciful, or by saying, well, I can rule it out for this reason. Mm-hmm. The typical thought there is, the standards kind of shift the knowledge by introducing certain scenarios that need to be ruled out. And that, in the kind of case this to do with canonical works, it looks like, again, you could go on either way. You say, well, the kind of skeptical scenarios are too fanciful to be probably introduced anyway. Or if they are introduced, can be kind of dismissed by just showing how unlikely they are. Whereas, with less known works, that seems a lot harder to do.
Okay, fair enough. You mentioned that the test of time, before, in the history of which, as you put it, generations of critics, kind of agreeing on, coalescing on a similar judgment. Mm-hmm. I suppose. I think the problem that this debate is all about becomes very vivid when we're talking about contemporary art, particularly where there is no there is critical consensus on some contemporary artists, and of course, if you go to a museum or a gallery, you will see things that at least some people in the art world have agreed are, great work or, just worthwhile putting in the museum or worthwhile showing in a gallery. But of course, I mean, I'm sure you've gone to, concerts or galleries or museums or something, and, you see this stuff and you kind of wonder, why is this here? And I don't mean things like Jane Austen, you know, that's, you know, that these things have definitely passed the test of time. But when you don't have the test of time, are things worse for the optimist for contemporary art?
So no, in the end, I don't actually think so, no. So I think that a lot of contemporary art cases are the ones used to motivate pessimism.
Yeah.
I mean, going back to something I said earlier on, I think a lot of the reasons why I might be skeptical about someone else's judgment transmitted to us about contemporary art, I think I'm also skeptical about our own judgment. So again, if the judgment is not just judgment about what I found entertaining, what I enjoyed, what I didn't enjoy, if the judgment is trying to get something like a fact of the matter about, is this work really valuable? Is it really original? Is it really whatever else? Then, of course, the person testifying to me wouldn't have disagreement often from other people, particularly when it comes to controversial works of contemporary art. The person testifying might be influenced by irrelevant factors like some kind of current trend. So going back to, I mean, Hume, it's a discussion about the test of time, talks about, well, people being, you know, bad authors getting temporary vogue because of fashion or because of like who they're friends with or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And again, that can happen to lots of contemporary art. But of course, that can happen to me as well. So I'm not like immune to these factors. I think it's, again, something where I think we underestimate testimony. In general, we think, well, other people are susceptible to fashion, susceptible to current trends, susceptible to making certain kinds of mistakes. We kind of overestimate how much influence other people and underestimate how much they influence us. So I think kind of really kind of getting to the truth about the aesthetic status of a lot of kind of contested artworks can be really difficult. But I think that's not particularly difficult in the case of testimony. It's just a general difficulty that applies just as much to first-hand judgment as well.
I'm not sure I buy that. I suppose I can be mistaken about my first-hand judgment or change my mind upon reconsideration. It seems that if I'm, I'm not sure how to put the worry. Again, it's one thing for me to form my opinion and thereby, you know, change it or whatever. And it's another thing, it seems, another question is whether someone else can learn about a work through the opinion that I am now expressing. Yeah. Do you see what I mean? I mean, I can change my mind and then testify something else, right? I mean, that seems to be a different issue from, does the person who hears me get knowledge?
So can you say a bit more to explain the concern? I'm not quite seeing it, I don't think. Sorry.
Okay. I mean, I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. But you have a number of times you sort of draw a parallel between certain difficulties with, you know, you might say with accepting testimony, and then the difficulty you might have in the first person case. And I was trying to say they don't seem as parallel to me as
Yeah, good. So I think that, and again, I think certainly are differences when it comes to, I guess, testimony in general. So if I tell you I sort of saw Bob like yesterday, then like I'm sort of thinking, well, actually, was it Bob or was it Bill? I'm not sure. So it feels like certain things that can do with testimony in general, where like, you know, once I've told you something without any kind of extra context, again, it's not the kind of case we're thinking about here where I just testify. Here's a fact. I don't say anything more about why I believe that or any background.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I can kind of reflect on your judgments in a way that you can't. And again, I think this leads to this other kind of symmetry that the pessimist wants to make between aesthetic testimony and other kinds of testimony. So again, they think, well, when I tell you I saw kind of Bob the other day, you can often come to know that, you can probably judge that on the basis of my testimony. And of course, it's possible I might kind of worry about that myself. Think, well, actually, was it Bob or was it Bill or this dot, dot, dot? But again, I'm kind of not sure these differences kind of are particular to aesthetic testimony. I think that's often the big challenge that a pessimist will face. There are concerns you can raise about aesthetic judgment. I mean, is there really a fact of the matter? What about this agreement? They're kind of ocean ways about testimony, but I think part of the kind of pessimist view seems to be committed to there being something specifically kind of problematic, something bad or worrisome about aesthetic testimony. I think that's much harder to isolate.
Okay. Okay, fair enough. So let me just, towards the end of the book, you defend a general norm of aesthetic assertion. That you put forward as a kind of a neutral a neutral norm that both sides, you know, okay, we can agree on this. And then the problem for both sides, again, is to explain violations of the norm.
Yes.
So can you explain this neutral norm of aesthetic assertion and why you think the optimist does a better job of explaining violations of the norm than the pessimist?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So the rough thought here, we're talking about assertions, and one kind of often implicit, but I think quite common argument in favor of pessimism is the idea that if I just tell you the painting is beautiful, but I've never seen it, that seems really strange, just that kind of assertion. So if I tell you that the painting is beautiful, you'll often, I think, legitimately infer that I've seen the painting myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something where a sort of very kind of straightforward argument for that would be, well, that's because there's like a knowledge norm on assertion, and if a certain kind of pessimism is correct, I can't know the painting is beautiful without having seen it. So if I tell you the painting is beautiful and I haven't seen it, I'm violating that knowledge norm of assertion. So that's kind of a very sort of standard pessimistic thought perhaps there. And I think the rough thought is that, again, in that case, it's framed in terms of experience. I think experience is perhaps not the right way to frame things because of certain cases where it seems like there's works of art you can engage with without having experience necessarily for yourself. So a lot of works on conceptual art, for example, I describe a work of conceptual art to you, you can kind of understand kind of what's going on there perhaps. So I'll talk about something like Tracy Emin's Unmade Bed. I said, put her like Unmade Bed in a gallery. It's very chaotic and it's dot, dot, dot. It doesn't look like after like I've seen the exact arrangement of the clothes on the Unmade Bed, you kind of get a lot of what that work's aiming to do. So I think something like this, the thought is that in order to make this kind of assertion, I have to have something like enough kind of grasp of understanding of what's going on using my own aesthetic faculties, using my own abilities as aesthetic judge, aesthetic reasoner, aesthetic whatever else, after I've done enough to myself to make that kind of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And my thought is there, well, I think the optimist can explain that by saying, well, look, there's some particular norm of assertion going on here in the aesthetic case that kind of makes those kind of cases problematic. It isn't just a standard topic neutral knowledge norm. And again, the rough thought I try and suggest is that there's some link here to something like snobbery again, that we kind of want to differentiate cases where someone has like made a judgment for themselves, cases where someone's kind of passing on someone else's judgment as someone else's judgment, cases where someone's kind of passing off someone else's judgment as the results of their own kind of contemplation, their own judgment, etc. So I think that in a lot of cases, if I tell you that it's 12 degrees outside, you don't really care whether I got a thermometer out myself or looked at the weather or asked a friend. You don't kind of care how I got that information. But lots of times we seem to care about how people came to know or came to believe certain aesthetic facts. We care about people's kind of history as aesthetic judges. And that's something where I think kind of having these norms in place can help us to kind of police that. It's kind of a very like much more kind of in-depth story I give in the book, but that's the rough thought, that the norm here is something like a pragmatic norm of assertion rather than any kind of generalized norm, like knowledge norm that applies more generally.
Mm-hmm.
I think a few reasons why I think this is a better approach. I think one, just general one, is how complicated the issue seems to be. So it seems like it's not like a straightforward, you can't go around asserting aesthetic judgments unless you've seen the thing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of looks like, again, I can sort of say the norm might be beautiful without having seen them myself, because that's just like a well-known thing. I'm back in the example of that. Yes, it looks like the cases where I could say that something like Lost Work was beautiful or whatever. So say like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon were incredibly beautiful. Then again, I think that's a case where that seems fine to assert that. And I think on my explanation, that seems perfectly legitimate because, well, no kind of reasonably well-informed person would think I saw the Hanging Gardens of Babylon myself. So there's no kind of room for confusion there. Whereas if there was the kind of norm the pessimist thinks was in place, this kind of knowledge norm or something like that, that would seem to be in place kind of across all cases. Where I think that what happens is you get a complicated system where like there's a norm that holds in some cases, not others, that kind of applies differently to different kinds of case. And that makes it look a lot more like something like a pragmatic kind of norm that the kind of suggests than the kind of norm that pessimists suggesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Again, I talk about individual particular cases where I think that the optimist actually does a better job of explaining these things than the pessimist.
Right. So let me just, one of the things that you say at the beginning of the book, as I remember, I think in the introduction or first chapter, one of your goals, of course, is to defend the optimistic position, but also you make a very suggestive comment about aesthetic testimony and social epistemology. But you don't really develop it in the book, and so I was wondering if maybe you might be able to say a bit more about that, because that just struck me as a very interesting new direction, to be combining those two things, and there is obvious, in a way it's like why hasn't this been done, in a way, but could you say a bit more about that integration that you kind of want to promote?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm hoping no one else does it because I'm kind of wanting to do it myself. But I think the thought there is just the idea that I think because testimony has been sort of seen as like a no-go kind of thing in aesthetics, I was talking about earlier, this idea that we can kind of think of ourselves like forming our own judgments into a vacuum, independent of what other people are doing. I think that's kind of led to a lot of recent developments in social epistemology elsewhere. I think about how we form judgments as groups, how we kind of handle disagreement, things like that, not being fully developed or as developed as much as could be in aesthetics. So that's something, again, I'm really thinking about. It's interesting to try to develop that. So one thing, again, I've got some recent work with Becky Wallbank. We talk about, again, things like the more social side of aesthetics. So I mentioned T. Wen thinking that a big part of our kind of aesthetic practice is something like puzzle solving, figuring things out for ourselves. That's a big part of the practice. I think that's true in some cases, but I also think that a large part of our practice involves communicating with things with other people. So again, we kind of, you might really want to convince me that the Barbie movie is a good movie, and that's something that people sort of spend a lot of time doing. We seem to kind of want other people to kind of come around to our way of seeing, or to kind of develop like a shared way of seeing things between different groups, particularly groups of things like friends. We want people to share aesthetic tastes, be kind of conform to at least some of our central aesthetic judgments about particular cases. We go and see movies with friends. That's, again, quite a strange thing to think about it, because, well, we're sort of sitting in a dark room, like Dr. Talk. We kind of go and do that with other people as a social activity. I think in general, with our engagement with artworks, that is very often a social thing. I mean, not necessarily, but I think very often if we go to a concert, a movie, a gallery, we'll be with other people and then kind of, well, Perhaps during, if we're allowed to, but certainly afterwards we'll talk about what we thought, why we thought it, compare notes, kind of argue back and forth. And I think there's lots of stuff happening here, like very much a social epistemological kind of thing, but that doesn't really get much kind of focus, that doesn't really get much discussion. And that's something really good to kind of develop that and think, well, what roles these things play in our aesthetic practice and why? So yeah, I think that why is it that we kind of talk about these things? Why is it we want people to agree? I mean, certain stuff, again, like going back to kind of people like Kant before, thinking about, well, aesthetic judgments kind of demand agreement. But even that's not true about aesthetic judgments in general. We're so keen on demanding agreement about those kind of things. Why, like, we ourselves want to talk about it so much, want to discuss it so much that, again, if you look at people, like, just general, like, I think, as I said before, one of the main things people seem to debate or discuss is aesthetic matters, talking about films, talking about music, talking about whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth thinking about why it is and why these kind of social factors play such a big role. I think they often play a big role in, for example, kind of group bonding or group development, that you want to have, like, well, these are the kind of things our group values aesthetically that this kind of out group or different group doesn't value. So yeah, I think basically that a lot of kind of work in aesthetics has focused very much on perception, treating aesthetics as an area where we're just like by ourselves, like engaging with works, mm-hmm. rather than something we do cooperatively or socially. I think once we kind of understand the extent to which these social factors really are, I think, at least in my view, kind of important to our aesthetic practice and our aesthetic judgments themselves. And that's something, again, I think is kind of really worthy of further study that hopefully I'm going to get to do myself at some point soon.
Okay, good. We're sort of running out of time, so let me, and this might just be a follow-up of that, but is that what you're working on now? What's on your plate at the moment or for the near future?
So I think I'll probably take a little bit of a break for that for the time being, because I mean, I love a site testimony to an impossible extent, but I've probably spent quite a long time working on that over the last quite a few years. So I'm working on a couple of projects at the moment. I'm working on stuff from some video games still. That was the first thing I worked on in aesthetics. I'm still working on some stuff there. I'm working on some stuff on God and beauty as well, thinking about kind of claims about God being beautiful that have been made in particularly Christian religious traditions, thinking about how we understand those. Yes, it's kind of a couple of things I'm working on at the moment.
Good, good. Okay, well, I look forward to seeing that. But we are out of time for the moment. So I just want to thank you for taking the time to talk about your book and try to convince us of optimism with aesthetic testimony.
Well, thanks so much, Carrie. It's great to have the invite and lovely talking to you.
Great, thanks. Bye-bye. You've been listening to my interview with John Robson. We've been talking about his new book, Aesthetic Testimony, An Optimistic Approach, which is just out from Oxford University Press. John Robson is an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Nottingham. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening, and until next time.